fantastic to be back with you, especially on a week which is so exciting, so dramatic, and so tragic. Between last week and this week, it's really one giant tragedy, as we'll see. A tale of two tragedies. I'd like to look this morning with you a perspective on the Dor HaMabul and the Dor HaFlaga, the generation of the flood and the generation of the tower. But put that in perspective of some of the other stories of Sefer Bereishis, and maybe we'll see a trend developing over the course of these two parshas of Bereishis and Shemos. So just off the bat, just the front cover already gives you a sense that these are comparable stories. The story of the flood and the story of the Migdal Bavel, which we know were two calamities resulting from people's errant ways. We'll talk about exactly what that's about in a second. And they come in close proximity. They're in the same parsha. So it seems like these have a lot in common, these two tragedies, I would say. People did something wrong. God came down with a really heavy hand and smashed them. But, as we'll see shortly, there are some salient differences between the Dor HaMabul and the Dor HaFlaga. What I'd like to explore is those differences and the nature of the difference between these two events. So take a look on page 1. The Torah begins describing the background for the generation of the flood. Eila told us Noach, Vat third pasuk and Yud Aleph, Vatishachis ha'aretz lifnei ho'elokim. The land became corrupted. Vatimolei ha'aretz chamas. And the land was filled with chamas. So we have the background. The land was filled with robbery, with corruption. And then the Torah goes on to tell something very interesting. Vayar Elokim es ha'aretz v'hinei nishchasa. God saw the land, it was depraved. Ki hishchis kol basar es darko al ha'aretz. All of flesh corrupted its ways on the earth. Fast forward just one perek, the Mabul comes down, says the Torah, Vayigva kol basar haromes al ha'aretz. All living creatures that crawl the earth expired. Ba'of uva behema uva chaya uva chol asheretz asheretz al ha'aretz. V'chol ha'adam. Everything. Everything was destroyed, eradicated. So the first observation is, first of all, the flood, and I bring these to your attention not because I don't think that these are unfamiliar, these are probably very familiar, but it's worth, sometimes, I think, taking a fresh look, a basic look at the text that you're familiar with. One of the problems, I would say, I heard this from a great Tanakh teacher, his name is Rabbi David Foreman, who is a very prominent Tanakh teacher. He taught Tanakh at Johns Hopkins University, and now he lectures worldwide. He's an important author, very important figure in the Tanakh study world. So he points out, he says, one of the challenges of knowing the Torah is that we know the Torah. Because the Torah is written so that we should be surprised as it develops. And we're never surprised because we always know the ending, so we should read it fresh. So the first thing that's very startling about this, just interesting, that the Ribbono Shel Olam would choose to completely and totally wipe out the world that he created. Utter destruction. A, complete punishment. And number two is that it involves the animals. Like, since when do animals have Bechira Chavshis to choose Bein Ra L'Tov? And even if they don't have Bechira Chavshis, how did they get involved in this in the first place? So the Gemara, the Talmud, and Sanhedrin, already in Source 3, picks up on this, takes note of this. Kihishchis kol basar es darko al ha'aretz. Amar B'Yochanan, melamed shehirviu behema al chaya v'chaya al behema. That the animals were intermating. They were breeding with all different types, inappropriate animals. Chaya al behema v'hakol al ha'adam v'al ha'adam al ha'kol. People with animals and other animals with other animals. And it was just a complete ruination of the natural order. So it seems that this is one event, one type of destruction, which is meted out because of a certain type of depravity. That's one story. Let's contrast this interesting notion that the animals, even the animals were sinning, with the story of the Migdal Bavel, of the Tower of Bavel. So I'd like to ask somebody to read this story, because it's a great story. And if you could figure it out on the first read, I tip my cap. Someone who wants to read the story, very brief story, of the Migdal Bavel? Because I'd like to just point out some very interesting oddities. No, not a long time. David, it means I think you're the man.
All right. The whole earth was one language and of common purpose. And it came to pass when they migrated from the east, they found a valley in the land of Sinar and settled there. And they said one to another, come, let us make bricks and burn them in the fire. And the brick and the bricks served them as stone, and the bitumen served them as mortar.
So hang on. So far, how bad are we? How are we doing here?
They're building a building.
Building a building, right? This is the big dig, the first big dig. Anybody familiar with the big dig? At least a nod. No. Not one.
Boston.
Oh, yes, thank you. Baruch Hashem. All right, yeah, there is a famous project called the Big Dig in Boston, which was started many years ago. And it was it's one of these classic capital improvements that got a little out of hand. So it's like 10, 12, $15 billion over budget, 15 years late, whatever. Anyway, so this is the big dig. And if you want to know something else, I would think that this is so far a fabulous introduction because we are told that the whole earth was one language and one purpose. Could you get better than that? One language and one purpose. Unity. Safa echas. It's fantastic. So what happens?
And they said, let us build us a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed across the whole earth.
So far, they're saying, let's build a giant building, and we'll make sure that we keep our civilization together. Who could argue with that? And it's so nice, right? We want to maintain the unity that we've created. We don't want to end up scattered all over the place. We want to have our nice little close-knit community. Okay?
And Hashem descended to look at the city and tower which the sons of man built. And Hashem said, behold, they are one people with one language for all. And this they began to do. And now should it not be withheld from them all the purpose to do? Come, let us descend there, confuse their language, that they should not understand one another's language. Mm-hmm. And Hashem dispersed them from there over the face of the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. This is why it was called Bavel, because it was there that Hashem confused the language of the whole earth, and from there Hashem scattered them over the face of the whole earth. So what they didn't want to happen, happened.
Exactly. So apparently the punishment was not that they were destroyed. If you compare this, this very tragic criminal episode, a terrible incident. So there, they were not punished in the way that the Dor HaMabel was punished. The entire civilization was not wiped out. They were scattered. And if you look in the Midrashim here, there's some discussion about some of them, a group of them were killed, some of the building was destroyed. But I don't understand. But the good thing...
The question is, as Mr. Aronin read the story, is why?
What did they do wrong?
Why? What's wrong?
Oh, so do you know that you were not the first person to ask this question?
I believe that's probably true.
And not only that, I wasn't the first person either. If you look in Source 5, the Medrash Rabbah, and what's so interesting to me is that the Medrash makes this point twice. If you open the Medrash Rabbah and you go through the entire Medrash Rabbah in this whole parsha, the Medrash twice makes the point that you just made. And it contrasts it to the story of the Dor HaMabel. It says, Reb Lezer Omer, what does it mean? Dvarim achadim, which David very nicely translated as common purpose. But let's look at the words literally. Vahi kol aris, top pasuk, safa achas, one language, udvarim achadim. Singular words. So it could be translated as ichud, unified words, common words. It could be single words. So the Medrash says, Dvarim achadim, diburim achadim. Sparse words. What does it mean? Sparse. Sparse words. Why sparse? The Medrash says, Maaseh Dor HaMabel nisparesh. The incident of the Dor HaMabel was clarified by the Torah what they did wrong. Maaseh Dor HaPalaga lo nisparesh. It simply is not cleared. It's not clarified what was the maisa here. What did they do wrong? The Medrash itself acknowledges that we don't understand what they did wrong.
Is it possible the fact that they said to heaven
with its top to the heavens.
Excellent. So that's one. That is one approach in the Medrash.
Right.
So there are multiple approaches that work on that verse. One is that they made a cheshbon. Every 1,656 years, they said to themselves, apparently the heavens open up and wash out the all of existence, the entire face of the earth. So what we're going to do is we're going to build supports. We're going to build a giant support system in the four corners, the far reaches of the earth, and support the heavens with these giant towers. That's one approach in the Medrash. This approach, by the way, is also very troubling. Why that's problematic? Because, you know, if there's a natural phenomenon that's bearing down on them, so what are we supposed to say? You know what? I'd rather stand in front of that tsunami at the edge of the beachhead and just say, yeah, let's see if it'll wipe me away and leave me in the hands of God. We know that's not the Jewish approach. We know that when it comes to scientific discoveries, the Meiri writes this and many others write this, that it's up to us to develop the world to fight AIDS and to cure all kinds of things and cancer, all that kind of stuff. So why can't they just build, why can't they build supports? And so now I'm I'm moving off course, but I think some of it has to do with a parallel medrash, which also points out that they seem not to take the lesson of the Dor HaMabul. The notion here might be that they said, oh, what do we have to learn from the Dor HaMabul? What we learn from the Dor HaMabul is that there's this really crazy scientific phenomenon. Instead of learning from the Dor HaMabul, oh, the reason why the flood came was because they were completely and utterly depraved society. So they missed the whole boat. And maybe that's why they're being punished here, for repeating the old story of not learning from the sin of the generation of the Mabul. That's one package possible. That's a possible answer that seems to be offered by the Medrash. There is another and others, but yeah. Somebody I want to chime in? Yeah.
With its top in the heavens.
Yeah.
I'll get back to that for a minute.
Yeah.
So they're aspiring to be someplace that perhaps they're not supposed to be. That they're going upstairs and they have no place upstairs. And that's really the sin.
Right.
Apparently, it would appear that with their unity and commonality of purpose, which is not bad, the only thing that seems to stand out is that they want to go all the way up.
Very good. So that would, by the way, that would mean what Vern might suggest is that it doesn't literally mean that there's a problem to build a giant skyscraper. When it says Verosho Bashamayim, it doesn't really mean the problem is that the building will reach the sky. There's nothing wrong with going in the sky. What the implication is that they are going up into the heavens, meaning against God.
Yeah.
In a spiritual sense, not in a physical sense. Which is another approach in the Medrash, that what they said was, you know, God, we're really not interested in you ruling the earth. So what we're going to do is we're going to kind of figuratively stick it to you. We're going to build a tower that reaches all the way to the heavens. And the Medrash says they're going to put an idol on the top of this tower with a sword pointed toward the heavens. As if to say, you know, you stay up there, we go down here. So that is another approach to what's going on here in the story. But
We see here, v'nasa lanu shame. I think that's
very good. That's another diuk. V'nasa lanu shame. Let's
why
make a name for us.
Why are they doing this?
Very good. Okay. So these are all very important observations, and I'd like to use them to kind of distinguish and look at, to contrast, these two stories that we just read. The first being the story of the Dor HaMabul, where there was complete eradication, and there was somehow this involvement of animal life, as opposed to the Dor HaFlaga, where it wasn't complete eradication. Based on what we're talking about here, there was some kind of sin. Hard to figure out exactly what that was, but whatever it is, it didn't warrant the same type of punishment that happened to the Dor HaMabul. And why not? What's the difference between these two strains? So I'd like to suggest is maybe it relates to another story. If we could set up, as it were, a schematic in our mind, that we put the Dor HaFlaga and the Dor HaMabul up on the chart. Here's the Dor HaMabul, and here's the Dor HaFlaga. We might find a parallel, actually, in a different story with two figures earlier in the Parsha. Vayiyu b'nei Noach hayotzim min hateva, on page, on source 7. Says the Pasuk, The children of Noach who got out of the Teva were three, Shem, Cham, and Yefes. The Torah tells us, Noach had three sons. So let's talk about these three sons for a moment. What happens to them? Noach gets out of the Teva, he plants a vineyard, and he ends up getting drunk. He's intoxicated in his tent. Vayizgal besogolo. He's now unclothed. He's naked in his tent, says the pasuk in Chaf Beis. Vayarcham avi kenan eis ervas aviv. Vayagid lishnei echav bachutz. Cham sees his father lying naked, and what does he do? Nothing. As we'll see later, he may actually have done something truly wicked. At least minimally, from a text perspective, he does nothing. Terrible disgrace he does to his father. And he goes outside. You almost, again, it's not in the text, but you almost get this, the impression that when he tells it over to his brothers, he's not whispering it to them to say, hey guys, we got to figure out something to do to the father. And we need to help him out here. If he wanted to help him out, he would have picked up an army blanket, put it over him, and finished. What does he do? You get the impression he's telling his brothers, he's mocking the father. He goes, you see what's going on over there? He is a really depraved character. Lo aleinu. Then the pasuk says, "Vayikach Shem vayefes es hasimla, vayasimu al shechem shneihem." And Shem and Yefes take the simla, which means the cloth, the blanket, and they put it on the shoulder of the two of them. Vayilchu achoranis, and they walked backwards. Vayichasu es ervas aviyim, and they covered over the nakedness of their father. Ufneiam achoranis ve'ervas aviyim lo ra'u. So what happens? Noach wakes up and he figures out what happens, what his youngest son did to him, Benoha Katan, and he curses Cham. Oru Kanan, who is the son of Cham, which is not going to talk about why he cursed Kanan, not Cham. Okay, Baruch Hashem Elokei Shem. Then he blesses Shem. Yaft Elokim liYefes v'yishkon be'olei Shem. And Yefes is beautiful. Yaft Elokim, Yafeh. He is beautiful. And he should dwell in the tents of Shem. So it's interesting. In the blessing, it's not Baruch Hashem Elokei Shem and Yefes. It's Baruch Hashem Elokei Shem. And oh, as an afterthought, Yaft Elokim liYefes v'yishkon be'olei Shem. God should grant beauty and grandeur to Yefes. He should dwell in the tents of Shem. So who is the primary recipient of the blessing here? Shem. Yefes is an appendage. So why is that? So maybe it's indicated already earlier. Very good, thank you. So if you go back, there seems to be a problematic line here, a verse in the pasuk, where it says, Vayikach Shem Vayefes es hasimla. And Yefes, Shem and Yefes took the garment. What does it mean? Yefes, Shem and Yefes took the garment in Hebrew. How would you have said that? Vayikhu. And they took. It doesn't say that. It says Shem. It says Vayikach, and he took. Who's he took? It should say, and they took. First it says, Vayikach, and then it says, Vayosimu, and they placed it. Vayichasu, and they covered. But it said, at the beginning, only Vayikach. So what does Rashi say? Says Rashi, Vayikach, Shem Vayefes, Inksiv Vayikhu, Ela Vayikach. Limeid al Shem, Shenis Ameitz B'mitzvah, Yosir Miyefes. Hence, Shem, you see from the pasuk, Shem took the initiative. He exerted himself and extended himself in this mitzvah greater than, more than Yefes. That's what the pasuk learns, teaches, according to Rashi. So Shem is the hero of the story, but I'd like to look at these two characters, Cham and Yefes. Cham is really a terrible, terrible person. Rashi says here, Vayar Cham Avi Kanan. What did Cham do? Es Ervas Aviv. Yesh Me Rabo Seinu Omrim. Top of the source 8. Some of tradition, this is based on a Gemara in Sanhedrin. Omrim Serso. That he castrated his father. Vyesh Omrim Rivo. And some say that he sodomized his father.
That he what his father?
Sodomized him. Oh. What a terrible thing for a son to do to the father. So Ham is a purely wicked son, and he receives a curse, Shein Kamoho, a terrible curse. And what's the story with Yefes? Why is Yefes not taking the initiative? What's wrong with Yefes's personality here? And how does that relate? How is this personality of Yefes not taking the initiative? He's not getting punished, but he's not getting the full blessing. And what's this whole idea that he's kind of blessed with the notion of Yafyafu social Yefes, with the beauty of Yefes? I wonder if we're in our mind, we're now setting up again this dichotomy between pure evil, between completely depraved, and something, a modified version, something not righteous, but not worthy of complete destruction, of complete cursing. Let's take one more, I would say, dichotomy. It's not in your packet, but we all know the story of Cain and Hevel. Cain and Abel, two brothers, the first two brothers of all time. So Cain is an Oved Adama, he's a farmer. Hevel is a shepherd. They bring a korban. Hashem turns to Hevel's offering, not to Cain's offering. Cain's angry. Vayhi biyosam basodeh. They were in the field. Vayokom Cain el Hevel ochiv. Vayahargeu. Cain kills his brother Hevel. So let's look at these two characters. Because after the death of Hevel, who comes along? The third son of Adam, and that is Seth, exactly. So already, by the way, in your mind, obviously you're thinking, interesting. Three sons of Noach, three sons of Adam. Okay? Who is the chosen son of Adam?
Probably would have had to have been Cain, only because he was the oldest.
Right, but who ultimately is the choice son?
Seth.
Hevel's not the choice son. He's killed off, he has no children. Who is the descendant? Who is Avram Avinu and Noah? Who are they descended from?
Shase.
From Shase. So we're already seeing it's going to be Shase and Shame. They're going to be the heroes of the story. And each of these stories has an extreme villain. Who is the extreme villain in the case of Noah? It's obviously Ham. In the case of Cain, it's also obvious. It's obviously Cain. He killed his own brother. But what's interesting to me is focusing for a moment on the character of Hevel. Abel. Because on the one hand, many have an interesting tradition that according to Kabbalistic notions, which you know that's deep waters, I'm swimming in the shallow. According to tradition, it could be that Moshe Rabbeinu himself was a reincarnation of the soul of Hevel. So obviously that's pretty good genetics there. If you're a reincarnation of Hevel, that's pretty good. On the other hand, what kind of a name is Hevel? Hevel means, if you read it on Koheles, every 5 seconds Koheles is telling us that this existence, Havel Avolim Kol Hevel, everything is Hevel, everything is hot air, it's nothing. Why do you get that kind of a name? We know that names, especially in Sefer Bereishis, are critically important. Cain, Konisi Ish, I acquired, which relates to the nature of Cain, which we'll talk about in a minute. That's a very important name. So Hevel is also an important name. And the fact is, again, I don't think it's fate, I think it's destiny. The fact is, Hevel is clearly not the chosen son to be the progenitor of the earth, of all of humankind. Case in point, he was killed out before he could have any children. So if he really was destined to be the father of mankind, to be the father of Avram Avinu, so it would have worked out that way, but it didn't. He was killed off and essentially kind of an ambivalent character, I would say, Hevel. Reminds us quite a bit of Yefes in the sense. You know, Yefes kind of does the right thing, but doesn't quite do the right thing. We can't figure out what happens there. He's on the right path, but he's not on the right path. Hevel, he seems to be on the right path, but something goes wrong. Where exactly is he going wrong here? Cain is pure evil. Hevel is this ambivalent type of character. So maybe we could suggest that we have developed somehow a type of a theme between
What did Hevel do that you're saying we don't know? Whether it was this or that. In other words, when you saw Yefes, so he didn't take the initiative, but at least he participated in covering
who?
The father.
In Yefes.
Yes.
Yeah.
But, so Hevel, I thought he brought something good to...
He did bring a carbon, exactly.
Right.
But somehow that didn't merit him being the Av of humanity, and this the name Hevel seems to be there's something fishy here. If he brought a carbon that seems to speak highly of who he's about, and yet he has this very strange, terrible name, and he's ultimately just kind of a blip on the radar screen in terms of history. So he may not be an evil person. He's not an evil person, I should say, Chas v'Shalom. But why is he not the hero of the story? What happened to him? He could have been the hero of the story. Yefes could have been the hero of the story. But he's kind of an enigmatic character. Almost like each of these, if you're following where I'm going with this, each of these characters in my right hand, which is the story of the Migdal Bavel, which is an enigmatic story. What exactly did they do wrong? What went wrong there? And Yefes, what exactly went wrong with him? He was a good guy. He got involved, but he didn't quite get it. And Hevel also, a very enigmatic character. If you contrast this line, this approach to life, with the clear enemies, the villains of the world, the Voldemorts, I would say, you know, pure evil, which is Cain and Chum and the Dor HaMabul. These are clear-cut evil. They're all cursed. They're all destroyed.
But Cain, say it's pure evil. He's a murderer, but he did tshuva. He brought tshuva.
When I say pure evil, I mean it in a typological sense, in an abstract way. Obviously, nobody. There's no such thing as pure evil. There is no Voldemort.
Okay, because I mean, Hashem did not destroy Cain. Hashem allowed Cain to live because of the tshuva that Cain did. I'm not defending Cain.
Yeah. Okay. So Cain does cut a deal with the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's true, and he doesn't actually get killed out. But he's ultimately.
There's a question of how Hevel reacted with Cain also.
Yeah.
There is that question.
Because the Torah does not say Vayhi b'Yosef b'Sodeh, and then there's a big. What was the exchange in the field? Excellent. That's a good point. So I don't know. That's pure speculative among the Rishonim, the commentaries. But I don't mean to say Chas v'Shalom that Cain is the equivalent of the Dor HaMabul. Although it is interesting that there is not a remnant of Cain left in humanity, because it's all of Cain's descendants who are wiped out by the Mabul.
As long as you don't accept Rashi's statement that Naama is the son of Cain.
Ah, okay. Achos to Valkai and Nama. Right.
Nama.
Okay.
But I've read that she would have to be hundreds and
hundreds
of years
old.
Maybe.
She does say Nama is.
So, okay.
I have a little problem with blaming the victim in case of Hevel, as opposed to Yafeth, who was not a victim but didn't do as much as he could. There's a big difference between being killed and doing something.
Absolutely.
Could have done more.
I'm not blaming him for being killed, Chas v'Shalom. I'm just pointing out, it's interesting. It says, when I read the Torah from a new perspective, it just begs the question, why is it that destiny would have it that Hevel is not the one to be and Shase was the one to be? I'm not blaming him. But I don't think that in Sefer Bereishis you could just say, well, that's kind of the way that the story played out, and it just happened to be that this fellow has the name Hevel, which is a very striking, bizarre name. Very bizarre name, if you really take in the context of Koheles, and that he was almost a nondescript, anonymous character. He steps on the scene, he brings a carbon, and then he just disappears. He's just way off.
I think the problem with Hevel at that time is that he's a shepherd. And a shepherd at that time doesn't really contribute to mankind.
So maybe, although I would say the opposite. Some Mefarshim point out that a shepherd is a more dignified profession, in the sense that they have quiet time with their family and with the Almighty, and that they're not, that they spend the time away. They have, like, they live in tents with their families, and they just stay out there in the field. They don't interact with other people. They're not rooted in physicality. So I like to suggest, basically.
But, isn't the point really the fact of the first murder? Isn't that really the essence of it, that you have to understand what man is doing to man, and it's...
Especially brothers.
the first family...
That certainly plays a role, absolutely. But I'm looking at it from a global perspective. As I just opened the text, do I see a trend here? Do I see a pattern of especially in these two families, you've got three sons. One is the righteous son, one is the wicked son, and one is the kind of ambivalent son. That's what I'm wondering. And how do you figure that? How do you square that with the story of the Dora Mabel and Dora Flugga? So what I'd like to suggest to you is based on a long essay, which I never read the whole thing from Rabbi Soloveitchik, but it's an important theme, which is in sources 9 and 10. And that is that let's go back to the story of creation, where we find, in fact, two distinct descriptions of the creation of mankind. The first description, which is in Bereshis Aleph, which is what Rabbi Soloveitchik in his essay, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, refers to as Adam 1. Again, I'm not using that exactly as the model, but similar. Says Rabbi Soloveitchik, how is Adam Arishon, how is the first man and woman described in the first description of creation? Well, first and foremost, he is described in the context of the sixth day of creation, which was the creation of the animals. So the Torah describes, Vayomer Elokim Totzi Haaretz Nefesh Chayal Mina, the beginning of the sixth day, the earth should sprout forth all kinds of creatures, Chaya, Behema, Remes, these types of living organisms. And that happens. And Hashem saw it was good. And then, in the same context, Hashem says, Nasa Adam Bitzalmenu Kid Musenu, let's create man, and he will rule over all of these creatures. Vayivra Elokim es Adam Bitzalmo, Bitzalam Elokim Bara Oso, Zachar Unekeva Bara Osam. He created man, male and female. There was Adam and Chava, but how are Adam and Chava described? They are Zachar and Nekeva, male and female. That description of Zachar and Nekeva applies to Adam and Chava as much as it applies to the bears and the snakes of the world. It applies equally to human beings as it does to the natural biological animal kingdom. So that's the first description of Adam Arishon. Adam and Chava are Zachar and Nekeva. That's all. Says the Pasuk in the second description, second Perek, Perek Beis, same story, very different perspective. Vayitzar Hashem Elokim es Adam Ofer Mino Adama Vayipach Ba'apov Nishmas Chayim. God created man from earth, and in this case, he endows him. He blows into his nostrils a Nishmas Chayim. Vayihi Ha'adam, and the man became not Zachar and Nekeva, but rather Nefesh Chaya, a living soul. A nefesh chaya, says the Unkelus, the very old commentary on this side. This is one of the, maybe the original Aramaic commentary, the original commentary on the Torah, Aramaic. Unkelus Hager lived a very long time ago in the times of the Talmud, Roman Emperor, and the Roman Empire. What is he? Vahavas ba'odam, look at the last two words there, l'ruach mamalala. Adam Arishon was a ruach mamalala, a speaking spirit. That's the second description. So Rav Soloveitchik points out that these are two completely different views of human beings. Two different creations, two different planes of existence. The first way of looking at us as human beings is that what we could call natural biological man. That we are, on one level, natural organisms. We are beings of nature, and in that respect, we really are the same as every other animal. You go to the zoo and you see the apes and the chimpanzees and the people. One's on one side of the glass, the other one's on the other side of the glass. But the bottom line is, we got a lot in common. We're both creations of the sixth day, we're both animals. That's natural man. But then there's a second layer of the creation of human beings, and that is the notion that we are endowed with a ruach mamalala, a speaking spirit. The fact that we have communication through speech sets us apart from the animal kingdom. So on the one hand, yes, we are a part of the animal kingdom, we are part of the natural world, that's the base line of creation. The first way of looking at us, the most basic human qualities are animalistic. The animals eat, we eat. The animals reproduce, we reproduce. The animals, I don't know, all kinds of natural things, so we do the same thing. But we are endowed with a ruach mamala. We have a second tier. We have a whole other plane of existence, which is the olam haseichel, the notion of having an intellect, having human interactions, having a ruach lemalala, a nefesh chaya, a speaking soul. That speaking soul, that spiritual life, that uniquely human characteristic, that's the second level of creation. And perhaps what we're seeing here in the beginning of Bereshis is a corruption in these two typologies. First, and the most basic, the more hideous corruption of the basic natural existence. And then there's the corruption of the spirit, the corruption of the human faculties. And let me tell you what I mean, working backwards. We concluded the last of the three examples was trying to figure out the difference between Cain and Hevel. So take a look at this Abarbanel and the 15th century in Spain. Says the Abarbanel. Somebody want to read this for us? Very interesting perspective of the Abarbanel. It doesn't cost anything.
Abel was a keeper of sheep and Cain a tiller of the ground. Cain adapted the vocation of tilling the ground because he feared not God and ignored the curse of "Cursed be the ground for your sake," which was addressed to Adam, pursuing material things and the accumulation of possessions, symbolized in his name Cain, which comes from a Hebrew root meaning acquisition. Abel, however, the proud-hearted, who pursued illusory honor and lordship, became a keeper of sheep. For this reason, he was called Abel, vanity, since honors and offices are vanity.
Oh.
That's fascinating, considering who the Abarbanel was.
Right. So the Abarbanel suggests, that the difference between Cain and Hevel is that they were both flawed characters, from our perspective again, whatever that means. But there was a very fundamental difference. Cain, he is a kone. He tries to amass as much as he can, much like a natural being. You ever see a chipmunk? He tries to get as much stuff as he can get his hands on. Right? The squirrels go out there collecting. The animals try to mark off their territory. So Rashi suggests, as I'll say, perhaps what was motivating his murder of his brother? He didn't want to split the profits, a.k.a. he wanted the whole world for himself. He wanted his own material possessions.
He was selfish.
Completely selfish. It was a basic corruption of just his biological self. This is not a spiritual error. This is a basic corruption of being human, of being an animal, anything. Cain is ultimate, just grabbing everything he can get his hands on, much like an animal. So that's the first corruption of Adam HaRishon. The first layer, the more basic level. And that leads ultimately to killing his own brother. That's mamish like living like an animal. When you have two lions in the jungle, it doesn't matter whether they're brother and sister or mother and father. You know, if there's a piece of meat, you got to get a piece of meat. That's it. Living like an animal. The basic, just the most basic abrogation of human qualities.
Yeah, but
just let me finish this contrast. But, says the Abarbanel, that's not the case with Hevel. Hevel's mistake was not in that he was like an animal. He was the opposite. He was using his human endowed faculties. He was using his ruach mamalala, but he was using it in the wrong way. He was using it to be someone of vanity, of arrogance, of lordship over others. That was why he wanted to become a shepherd. So Hevel's mistake, the tragedy of Hevel, was that he misused not the first level of human existence, but the second. And therefore, we look at the punishments and the development of the characters in different ways. Hevel is not known, Hevel is not, in a sense, punished. That we don't punish the victim. We don't say that Hevel is a completely terrible person. He may have been the source of the Gilgal of Moshe Rabbeinu. There's possible, there's what to be misaking here. But on the other hand, he's Hevel. He's emptiness. Because he's misusing the possibility. There's a vacuum here of the possibility of what could have been for human beings. This suggestion may now explain the differences not just between Cain and Hevel, but turn the page, page 12, source 12.
Well, if you say that he's the Gilgal, Moshe Rabbeinu is the Gilgal of his neshama, so it makes sense in the idea that, so Moshe was also a shepherd, but totally the opposite. In other words,
on the modest. Very good, beautiful, exactly. And exactly. So says Rashi, why did Cham do this to his father? Why would he castrate his father? What's the motivation? So Rashi tells us. Says Rashi, Why did he do that? Amar lehem la'achiv. He said to his le'achiv, he said to his brother, Adam, Rishon shnei bonim hayu lo v'harag ze'eze b'shvil Yerushas ha'olam v'avinu yesh lo gimel bonim v'odenu mevakish ben revi. Why did Cain kill Hevel? Because he wanted to take possession of the world. And our father is going to have more children.
Is that the beginning of greed? The first greed?
Absolutely. Yes. The first children. So says Cham, he says, I don't want to split this pot with anybody else. We already have three sons. That's enough to split humanity. We're not getting involved with any more children here. Dad, that's it. That's the end of the story. Because Cham says, I'm like Cain, in a certain sense. I want to acquire as much land as I can, and therefore I'll get involved in the most gross and base activities. Mamish like an animal. He goes back, ruination of the first type of creation. Absolutely like an animal. Yefes, he's not like an animal. Chas v'shalom, he wouldn't do that to his father. But there's something wrong with the second level of understanding for Yefes. Rabbi Soloveitchik, in a different... this I heard from Rav Shechter Shlita, my teacher at YU. He pointed out a beautiful insight for Rav Soloveitchik. And he said the following. What's the difference, asked the Rav, between ethics and etiquette? So the difference between ethics and etiquette is that ethics dictates you do the right thing, no matter what the circumstance. Etiquette means that there are certain social graces, that there are certain social norms that are accepted when you are among other people, when you're among friends. But if you're alone in your the privacy of your own home, in your own room,
you can do what you want.
You do whatever you want from an etiquette standpoint. Says Rav Soloveitchik, that's the difference between shame and Yefes. Shame says, the father's in his tent, you got to do the right thing. Yefes says, he's in the tent, doesn't bother anybody. So he's disgraced, but that's okay. The minute that shame goes to clothe the father, etiquette dictates what?
Yeah.
You better help him out. You got to get there. So what does Yefes do? He says, okay, don't worry, you're going to move it, I'll move it too. But I'm not going to initiate because ethical behavior is not my calling. The seichel that with which he was endowed wasn't fully developed. The human quality of ethics, of doing the right thing, being different than an animal. Animal has no right and wrong, doing the right thing, doing the wrong thing. Animals do whatever drives their instinct. There is no right and wrong per se. There's no ethics for animals, but there are ethics for human beings. And that's why, just if you look back, I don't have time to develop it now, that's why Rabbi Soloveitchik says that Rashi says they each got a different reward. Shame was rewarded with the mitzvah of tzitzis, Rashi says. And Yefes, his generation's future, were rewarded, according to Tanakh, with kavura, with burial. Rabbi Soloveitchik says that's the difference. Tzitzis, you keep under your shirt. Tzitzis is a private matter. You do it because that's what you're connected to Hashem. Kavura is the opposite. There's nothing inherent, there's nothing ethical about burying the person. Why do you bury the person? Etiquette. It's not becoming to leave them lying around, to have a corpse floating around in the street. So that's the difference, he says, between Yefes and shame.
Is Yefes the root, like also, you said it, like he was very good looking or very...
Yeah, yeah.
So maybe that's also like a relationship to Hevel. In other words, it's a parallel, like a beauty or...
Exactly,
beauty
brilliant. Like and that's exactly who is, and this is not for now because we're about a month and a half early, who is the descendant of Yefes, source 14, in this week's parsha, Bnei Yefes, who are the children of Yefes? Gomer, Umagog, Umadai, V'Yavan.
The Greeks.
The Greeks! So who is more involved in their beauty and their aesthetics, the bodily image? It's the Greeks. But what happens? The Greeks take this idea of the Adam HaSeichel, of the spiritual, of the speaking spirit, of the Aristotle and the Socrates and all these things, but they just take it the wrong way. They take it to the extreme. They abuse, they misuse the God-given qualities of developing society, and they take it, and that's the whole clash between the Hellenists and the traditional Jews, to say, well, it's all about beauty. There's nothing inside. There's no such thing as holiness. It doesn't matter. Whatever's inside, the Greeks said, that doesn't matter. It's all about the outside. It's all about what it looks like. It's all about the etiquette. That's what the Greeks were claiming. That's what he said. What do you need Judaism for? As long as it looks nice and you can philosophize about it, that's good. And the Jews said, no. You're taking that gift of the second level of humanity you're misusing it. You're missing the opportunity. We think it's very important, but you have to give it a context. That's what the Gemara says in Source 13. You want to write a Sefer Torah. So there's one opinion in the Talmud that says you're not allowed to write a Sefer Torah in any language except for Greek. Why? Because he quotes the pasuk that we just read at the end of Source 13. Yaf delokim liyefes, yaf yefuso shel yefes, yeh ba'o alei shem. You can have the beauty of Yefes. Yes, it's important to have beauty, but it should be ba'o alei shem. It should be rooted with something on the inside. So Torah is not against Greek, you know, aesthetics. We are against the Greek way of life, which says it's all about the outside. It's a mistaken view that's all about etiquette, not about ethics. The Torah says, yeah, it's important to be beautiful. You want to write a Torah in Greek, go for it. But it's got to be Torah. It can't just be on the outside. So this is, again, the notion that you're developing here of hevel, of something vanity, something that's vain. Vanity meaning it's hot and good-looking on the outside, but really on the inside there's not much there. That's Yefes. That's what Yavan is all about. Maybe we can suggest that this is, again, the same notion of a mistaken view of the second. It's an errant way of developing the second level of humanity, and now we can go back and we can understand, maybe, ultimately, the development of the Dor HaMabul and the Dor HaFlaga. What was the Dor HaMabul a corruption of? The Dor HaMabul was... Oh, exactly. What does the Gemara say in Kuf Sanhedrin Kufches? Dor HaMabul lo nizgo ela bishvil tova sheyishpia lehem HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Dor HaMabul became haughty because of all the good things. They took the world in which they lived and they corrupted it. So Rashi says on Source 16, they were involved in Vatishaches Lashon Erva. That's what we quoted before. They were engaged in these immorality, these sexual practices that were completely deviant, animals with people and all this kind of stuff. That's a basic ruination of the creation of Adam as Zachar and Nekeva. God created Adam 1 as Zachar and Nekeva. The people said, yeah, it doesn't matter. It's basic, all free for all, completely. And therefore, what happens next? Also, Vatim al Eretz Chamas, Rashi says, Gezel. There was no property right. There was no respect for anybody else. It was a complete disintegration of society, back to the animal life. So what happens if you ruin the basic level of creation of Zachar and Nekeva? HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, whoosh,
you don't have nothing.
You have nothing. So we have to destroy the world back to the root, because they had essentially perverted even the most basic level of creation. Contrast that with now the Dor HaFlaga. So the Netziv has a brilliant insight into what the Dor HaFlaga is. An incredibly creative idea. He says the following. He says, why do you think they had a tower? What do they have such a big tower for?
So the water won't reach up there.
One second. Why do they have a big tower? Says the Netziv. He says it was very problematic to have one Safa, one language. He said this is brilliant, the Netziv. This is writing in end of 19th century. He says this was the first totalitarian regime. He says the purpose of the tower was to ensure security, that no one would leave the civilization, that they could patrol and keep a close eye on everything that was going on, so that it would be Safa Achas. Everybody had to believe the same thing. Who was the king? Nimrod. Nimrod was the first dictator, says the Netziv. He said, what I believe, everyone believes. It has to be my way. There is no room for a multiplicity of approaches. There is no room for a difference of ideas. It's all my way or the highway.
That's wrong.
He says, who was the one man to go against the tide? Avraham Avinu. And he says, that's how he got thrown into the fiery furnace. Not even so much that he was a monotheist, but he was a dissident. He was the first dissenter of all time. He stood up to the great big brother of the tower, who said, everyone has to believe what I believe. It's Safa Achas, one way or the highway. And Avraham Avinu said, no, there's another way. So Nimrod said, guess what? You're going in the fiery furnace. And that is, I would say, the same corruption as the Hevel of the Yefes of the world. It's not a corruption of the body. They weren't all trying to eat each other alive. It's a corruption of the spirit. It's a corruption of the intellect, of the Nefesh Chaya that they were given. They took their God-given endowments to create a civilization. And what kind of a civilization did they create? One which was completely corrupt. One which didn't give freedom of expression to all the different individuals. He suggests that it sifts further. That's why it says B'nei Ha'adam. B'nei Ha'adam meaning they were base human characters. There was no inspiration here of Das Torah. They weren't using the Torah, the moral and ethical purposes of the world to inspire their civilization. So what did it become? It became a police state with a giant tower. Pen nafutz. What does it mean, pen nafutz? So no one should leave. They were in lockdown, says the Netziv. They shouldn't scatter. It means they shouldn't scatter so no one could believe anything else. There shouldn't be any signs of dissent. So maybe this is the same, this same model of Hevel and of Yefes is playing itself out here as well. Yeah.
So I just wanted to expand on that, when the idea of Hevel. So we see that even if the people had a good intention, or the idea of Hevel, because they tried to build it so it reaches the heavens. But the Lashon says, like, Hashem descended. So in other words, no matter how high they thought they were getting, it wasn't that high. Because if Hashem has to descend, it means they didn't reach
very good
where they thought.
But the idea is, like you said, but the idea is that they were using their faculties. They weren't being animalistic like Cain or like Chum or like the Dor HaMabul. They were using their faculties, but they didn't get the perspective right. They were just a little bit off. And now we understand why their punishment was not complete destruction, but dispersion. So that they could move out and try to understand the differences of language. They can understand that it's okay for different people to have different perspectives. And that Ruach Mamalo, a speaking spirit, means people speak differently. And that it's okay. We shouldn't abuse the notion of society and civilization. And this, I would suggest to you, is one way to view a macro level of the development of the society, of the development of these two trends of creation. So ultimately, who's going to be the hero? It's going to be Avraham Avinu. Because Avraham Avinu is the one who is able to be misaking, to perfect both the basic human level in terms of being a Baal Chesed, not being a grabber, not being Kayin, a Kone, not being Chum, but rather being an Ish Chesed who opens his doors and gives to everyone. So he fulfills the first basic human level of creation, but he also fulfills the second one. By what? By recognizing the monotheism of the world, using his Seichel to understand that there is a God. And that's what essentially is the tikkun of these first two generations. That's why we say there were 10 generations from Adam to Noach, 10 generations from Noach to Avram, Alman Avram v'kibol schar kulam. Avram Avinu was misaking everything because he fulfilled the ultimate dream of creation, both on a natural level and on a spiritual, intellectual level.
Is that the reason God chose him?
Yes,
after that?
Absolutely.
Can I grant?
Yes.
You said you were contrasting Shem, you were saying about the tzitzis, I missed that point.
Shame, who represents ethics, means you do the right thing even if nobody sees it. So I'm wearing tzitzis even though you don't see it. I don't think you can see it. No, this is a nice shirt. You can't see right through it. It's okay. You can't see it. So you do the right thing. That's why the Rashi says in source, if you go back to Rashi in source 8, Rashi says there, Lachach zachu banav letalis shel tzitzis, v'yefes zacha lekvura lebanav. And Yefes merited burial for his children. That's Rashi in source 8. So that's what Rabbi Soloveitchik suggested, that talis represents the close connection to God in a genuine sense.
Right.
And kavur just means for an etiquette, for a social convention, we want to make sure that people, you know, it's really awkward to pass somebody in the street who's not alive. That's so, just kind of strange.
But,
yeah?
No. Who is he comparing now to the burial?
Yefes, who is this ambivalent character.
Right, I understand.
So he on the one hand, does something right. He does merit the burial, but...
But he's not doing it. He's doing it on outside. That's
exactly.
That's what he's saying to people to see it.
Exactly. So he's missing out. He doesn't understand the seichel, the notion of Torah, which is an ethical, moral imperative, which says, ethical imperative says, you go take care of the father. It doesn't matter whether people see it or not. That's a disgrace. That's what I would suggest. All right, have a wonderful Shabbos, everyone.
That too.
Okay.
So, does that mean that there's more than one point of view?
Are you going? I want to see if. Are you going Sunday to hear Rabbi Rosenblatt and Rabbi?